Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, everyone, and welcome, Sally. We're joined by Sally Goebel. Sally is engineering manager at Test. Well, welcome to the show, Sally. Thanks so much for taking the time to do this. We've got a really interesting conversation ahead of us, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's a pleasure. So the main question outline is around communication at scale. Before we get into that, it would be really nice to hear, you know, a couple of things from yourself. In a nutshell, what a test does as a service and what you provide there.
Yeah, so we are a B2B company. We provide a platform for customers who want to do research on their customers. So I guess maybe 20 years ago, if you were a company and you wanted to find out what your customers bought or they thought about your product, you'd go to a big market research company. They would do all the writing of surveys and mm-hmm. they would get focus groups and they'd get physical people into a room and they would do questionnaires, and that whole process would take months and months and months. What we do is we have a platform online so that customers can do their own research, and they can do it in the course of hours or days rather than months and months and months. It gives them the power to get insights into their customers.
Incredible. Amazing. And a little bit on yourself, actually, and your career. And I'm just interested to find out what your career journey has been like. And would you say that you've navigated it in any way, or has it just kind of formed its own path?
Yes, I like to think that I follow the pinball model of careers. So I had lots of careers before I went into tech. I have a degree in theoretical physics. I then went to work in the theatre because obviously that's what you do when you have a degree in theoretical physics, as a sound and lighting engineer.
Oh, excellent.
I then moved into the world of magazine production, like printed magazines. But I started doing that at a time when there wasn't really much digital production. Apple Macs were first being used to do kind of digital magazine production, but nobody knew how to use them. So I kind of ended up working with Macs and fixing them when people's computers went wrong, and learning all about the kind of software that ran on them, and helping people out with that. And I moved from that into kind of consulting on kind of other things like kind of networking and helping customers use the internet when they were first started. And then I got a job working with the Guardian newspaper. And first of all, I worked in their print side of the company, helping them kind of digitize their kind of print production. And at that point, the Guardian had just started going what they called web first, which was like having a workflow, which meant you could kind of choose to either kind of print into a newspaper or go to the web first,
right.
Kind of fork their production, basically. And I was working on the print side, but dealing with the kind of digital, the team that kind of ran the digital side of it as well. And then from then, I just made the leap over to the kind of fully digital side, started my career. And I was, at that point, I was involved in kind of software testing and QA. So I had done that for the kind of print side of it, kind of testing the plugins that the kind of the Guardian used to kind of work their print flow. And then I kind of went to working as a tester in the kind of digital side of the business at the Guardian. I did that for quite a number of years, became the kind of head of QA at the Guardian in the digital team. And then we decided that kind of QA wasn't really this is probably a bit controversial, QA wasn't a discipline that was going to last very long in the kind of digital world. And so our team kind of segued into being a team that was SRE, platform quality, post-production, kind of synthetic monitoring, those sort of things. And then I moved into kind of engineering, kind of platform engineering role. And now I'm right on the other side as of being an engineering manager.
Wow. Wow. What a story. What a career. What a CV. That's incredible. Really. I mean, you described it as like the pinball, you know, pinball method of, you know, career, but it's like, it seems like you've just followed your passion, and it seems to have happened quite naturally. I mean, from what you were saying, I mean, would you say that it's happened naturally, your career, or was there any really difficult aspects or parts?
Well, I guess it was difficult when I'd kind of spent a few years working as a QA to then actually make the decision myself or come to the realization that probably there wasn't much of a kind of a long career path in QA, which I still firmly believe. And then just thinking, okay, how can I kind of repurpose myself to be useful in another way? So that was kind of, that's probably like a little bit of a kind of a few kind of teary moments there probably. But, you know, it's all incredibly exciting. And I think it's exciting learning new things. And hey, isn't that great? Because we work in tech where you have to learn new things all the time. It's exciting shaking yourself up every few years to do something different, moving job, moving team, you know, learning something new. I think all of those things are super exciting to me anyway. I know some people are scared of change, but I really like it. So,
like you said, shaking things up. I think people, if you stay in the same team and the same job, and if you're not progressing in that role, you can really stagnate and then you can fall behind quite quickly with developments of technology. So I think it's important for people to move roles quite regularly, you know.
And it can be terrifying, right?
But, oh, yeah, it is. It is.
You know, do something that scares you every day. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. I wouldn't recommend changing your career every day, but give it a year or two. Yeah. But it, like you said, it is terrifying. I've been there before and it is. And I know a lot of people that stay in the same job, even if they don't enjoy it, they stay there because it's just comfortable and... Yeah, it's a bizarre thing, but it's true. We've got our main question outline here. We were going to get very carried away then, or I can feel myself I was. But the main question outline is communication at scale. Now, this is interesting because we've never had this conversation topic on the podcast before. So this is really interesting for me. So to kick things off with this, how can a business ensure that their communication is as effective as it can be?
I guess I guess before I answer that, I'm gonna just like fill in one little more gap in my career, which is I've gone from The Guardian, which was obviously all about communication and doing that well, but a very kind of historical organization that's been going for 130 years or something. And probably you'd call it kind of a medium scale, but kind of fairly established organization with established practices, to then working at Deliveroo, which is, you know, a kind of much larger organization in terms of the tech team, certainly, that moves at a breakneck pace, you know, with all the things that that entails, to move to working at a much smaller startup. So, so you know, Deliveroo was around 500 people in the tech team.
Wow.
And we at Attest have around 50. So working in a small startup was something I really wanted to do, or smallish startup was something I really wanted to do. But I've kind of seen communication from lots of different angles now, and seen the kind of joys and the kind of pitfalls of all of those things. So it's something that I'm super interested in, hoping not to make kind of, you know, mistakes that I've seen in the past at current company. So that was my preface. So you're asking me, how can business ensure that the communication is effective as it can be?
Yeah. I mean, it's a big question, isn't it? But we'll try and dig into that.
I think it's by recognizing what the kind of strengths and weaknesses are of a company at, you know, at any particular scale and where it kind of goes wrong, and recognizing those things and actively working on those things to make them better. Mm-hmm. I think there's a tendency to think, because we can all speak, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something we learn when we're, you know, one of the first things we learn. And I think people take for granted the fact that because we can all do it ostensibly, that we can all do it well. And I think that is not necessarily the case. I think two things. I think knowing the size of your company and what you do well in terms of communication, and knowing that actually communication is a thing that's hard, even though it seems to be easy, and giving people the tools to do it well and training people to be good at it.
Yeah.
I think are all things that are important, and looking for people who are good at it as well. When you're hiring people, think so important. And then when you can see it going wrong, then doing something quickly to fix it. Mm. So
absolutely. And it's so interesting in the tech world because, you know, the startups who might be like two people who start a business, and then in a couple of years' time, it could be a team of 100 people. How does that change then? I mean, how does communication change, or how should it be changed through that period of time?
I mean, that's the beauty of a small startup, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, COVID aside, you know, when you've got a small startup, you're probably a few people sitting in a room all on top of each other. Sales team are sitting beside, you know, the CEO who's sitting beside the two engineers who's, you know, sitting beside the office manager. You know, you've got one product and, you know, everybody knows what everybody else is doing. You know, you just turn around and you talk over your computer and you say, well, what do you think of this?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like so easy, isn't it? It's like informal. That's the kind of the model I like to have. It's like informal, easy communication as you would do, you know, as we're talking now, right? It's one-to-one. Yeah. It's very straightforward. And then the bigger you get, the that model is going to break because you may not all be in the same room.
Mm.
You may have more than one product and just things become more and more difficult. And then you have to start being conscious about communicating. And then when you're conscious or kind of more formal, you know, it becomes more formalized, that's when it starts getting more difficult. And it was really interesting when I joined a test. One of the things that kind of made me realize that things were different was we were, you know, we had about 25 engineers at that point. And I couldn't understand why we didn't have any tech talks or kind of learning, you know, things that the company were doing.
Mm.
And every company I'd ever worked in had all had, like, you know, Friday tech talks or show and tells or demos, or people would kind of have book clubs and things like that. And I was like, I couldn't understand why we didn't have any or why nobody was fussed that we had them.
Mm.
And I was like, but why haven't we got those things? And I just suddenly realized it's because we hadn't needed to have
right.
them, because people would just sit and talk to each
yeah.
other, you know, or they'd just be like, oh, I'm going to do a demo. Like, here, I'm going to turn around to my colleague
yeah.
who's sitting on my right and do a demo one-to-one.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't need to do like one-to-many things.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, it took me about 3 months of like puzzling to figure
yeah.
out why that hadn't been necessary, but it was necessary now, you know, it was necessary when I joined. And I was like, we need to do more things. We need to do mob reviews and things like that. But it just hadn't occurred to me that we'd that we'd kind of crossed the Rubicon from one to the other.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really interesting. And I'm just curious to find out what your opinions are on this. So what are some of the, you'll have seen some of the benefits and some of the negatives in your career, but what are some of the benefits that a business can expect by having, you know, a really well-oiled communication strategy in place?
I mean, happy
people.
Happy people.
Yeah.
Without putting to make it overcomplicating it.
Yeah.
Like I've got this, I remember a few years ago, I was working on a mobile app when I was at The Guardian, in fact, and we had the loading screen when you kind of first initialized the app. And it took about 20 seconds for the screen to load with all kind of current content. And we were doing this whole bit of work on like what to do to speed up the loading screen.
Mm.
And we had like a whole bunch of users and we compared it to all of our competitors. And the thing that we did that like had the most traction was to put in a progress bar, right?
Right.
Which was just like a kind of spinning G for The Guardian.
Yeah.
And, you know, as soon as people got that like progress bar and they knew what was happening,
yeah.
they were like happy to just like sit and look at the progress bar. And like, if that's not a good indicator of why communication is important,
yeah.
you don't have to like, you know, reduce the number of calls you
yeah.
make to the API or, you know, do any, whatever, you know, lazy load, forget all that, just put progress bar in. People know what they're doing. They'll, you know what's happening. They're happier. So, you know, same thing with customers as with your staff, right? If you know what's going on, you're going to be happier. If you have access to the information, you're going to be happier. One of the first things that happened when I got to a test was I went to a Friday all hands meeting and CEO stood up and he had the kind of the deck of all the company's finances to show to the whole company, like what we're doing, how we've done, what our kind of ARR was, or our average revenue was, you know, what our outgoings and incomings were. You know, it's amazing to see the transparency. And you're like, oh, I feel part of the process. I know what's happening. Nobody's saying this is information that you're not important enough to see. You buy into the company.
Yeah.
You feel like you're being told what's happening, and also that people are listening to you. Mm. You know, you feel it valued as an employee. Mm. You know, we treat our employees the same as we treat our customers by communicating with them and listening to them.
Well, absolutely. And transparency, you mentioned, is hugely important. I mean, especially as an employee and the employee-employer relationship. In any business, that's massive. And I've seen it a few times with, you know, friends of mine where they work in a business, but they're kind of left in a lot in the dark about what's been going on in the business. And it, especially during like COVID times, and you really need to know where the business is and what's going on. And I think some employers and businesses overlook that fact of having to have like regular contact with employees, just letting them know what's going on. But it can be so easily overlooked, can't it? You know, but you've got to be so super aware as a business and as an employer about these things.
And the thing is, I don't really think that any of that is conscious
either. Exactly, yeah.
I mean, obviously, as a leader or a manager, there are some things that you have to be very careful about talking about. And you sometimes have to be kind of very careful about talking about things in the right order to the right people, right? And, you know, stakeholder management. But there are some things that you just forget to talk about, because partly because they've been in your head for so long. Mm. That you've just suddenly assume that everybody else knows about them because you've been thinking about them for ages. So, for example, we're at the moment as a engineering leadership team, we're thinking about doing out of hours on call. Mm-hmm. Now we've been thinking about how to do that and talking about it for a little while now. And so, you can just kind of start assuming that everybody else knows about it because it's in your head and in your sphere.
Yeah,
and you're
absolutely.
But then if you suddenly went to your team and said, oh, by the way, we're doing out of hours on call and da-da, here's the policy.
Yeah.
There'd be a riot, okay? Yeah. Or there'd be a lot of disgruntled engineers, right? You want to talk to people about it. You want to solicit their opinions. You want to share drafts with them. You want to, in a way, you want to kind of like leak out bits of information and have frank conversations with people along the way. I think those things are going to make everybody feel like they're part of the decision-making process, feel that they're heard, that they're listened to, and it's going to make people trust you more and ultimately be happier. So,
absolutely. And, you know, how can employers smoothly transition from informal communication to formal communication? And I mean, I imagine that at some stage throughout a business's growth, that has to happen. Am I right there?
Yeah, I think that's that thing. You're sitting in a room, you know, it's a small startup, you can talk casually to everybody, and then suddenly you think, oh no, and we can't do that anymore. We've got to formalize it all.
Yeah.
And then I think that's where the problems come in, to be honest, because you just kind of turn the dial in the opposite direction, don't you? And you decide that you need to formalize everything. So you start having meetings for everything. You start documenting every single thing. And then you kind of have death by meeting, where everybody goes to every meeting. Everybody feels they have to go to every meeting because, first of all, there was a position where everybody knew everything. And then you're in a position where you have meetings about everything, and then everybody's like, well, I don't want to miss out.
Yeah.
I need to go to all the meetings. And then some people want to go to all the meetings and some people don't want to go to any. And, you know, you basically just kind of turn the dial and then you have to kind of turn it back. And I think that's the difficult bit, is like turning the dial back to being, you know, somewhere in that kind of happy medium between overly formal and like, and having nothing.
Mm.
And I think documentation is another really good example of that. Mm. You know, you suddenly say, oh my gosh, we need to document everything. We don't have any documentation. And then you just like write every single thing down, even though nobody really needs to read it and probably nobody will ever read it again. You have documents in so many different places.
Yeah.
So just being very conscious, I think, about your strategy and saying, okay, we're gonna have one source of truth in one place. We're gonna be very kind of lightweight about what we document. We're gonna be very conscious about what you document. Mm. We're gonna make it all kind of searchable. We're gonna kind of archiving. Nobody ever archives any documentation, do they? They're just like, we will have it all here, so that in 6 years' time, we know why we. Nobody. We know why we made this decision. Nobody will care in 6 years. It's like you need a lean approach. That's what it is, right? Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
I haven't thought of this. It's like a lean approach to communication.
Yeah.
Right? Just do the things that you need to do and have an MVP for your documentation.
Yeah. A lot of times nowadays, there's the dreaded meeting about meetings, like you were kind of mentioning just then. And it just seems like, when that happens, a lot of people are wasting a lot of time. So how can you find that balancing act where it's only, you know, important stuff or anything that's useful that's actually being spoken about, really? Something that a meeting about something that could be just sent over an email, a group chain email, you know. How do you actively avoid that situation?
Yeah, I think there are like lots of techniques that you can use. I think first of all, you can have good meeting hygiene, right? You can make sure that every meeting has an agenda.
Yeah.
And that there is pre-reading for your meeting, if there is, allow people to leave meetings. You know, not have it as a problem if somebody kind of leaves a meeting if they're not getting anything out of it.
Right.
I mean, a really good one that we've started doing fairly recently is videoing, especially if you're doing things remotely, right?
Yeah.
Video your meeting so that people don't feel that they have to go, and then they can watch them back, right?
At
1.5 times the speed. and then people don't have that kind of sense of, because, you know, if, especially if you have worked in a company where it's been small, you might have kind of FOMO for not going to a meeting and feel that you should go or feel like you're missing out. But if you can just like catch up on it on video afterwards and kind of get the key points out of it, it's really good. And then having people chair meetings as well, which is sometimes quite a difficult thing to do. But again, you can give people training to chair meetings well. And also just only having meeting. I mean, I think it's not having standing meetings.
Mm.
And by standing meetings, I mean meetings that recur over and over again, just for the sake of having them.
Yeah.
I think feeling empowered to cancel meetings if they're not useful or not needed. And I think that has to come from the top.
It does.
I think it can't just come from anybody. You have to be, you know, as a leader, you have to be ruthless about saying, well, why have you just invited me to this meeting that has no agenda?
Yeah.
And I don't know why I'm going, you know, what am I going to get out of it? And kind of set the tone for that for everybody else as well.
Well, especially when we're talking about, you know, if we're talking about engineering and engineering teams. Because I've heard businesses have stand-ups, you know, during COVID, I heard some businesses were having stand-ups every morning at like 10 a.m. or something. And if you're an engineer, you can't have focus period first thing in the morning for say 2 or 3 hours and then it'd be completely interrupted right when you're in deep focus for a 15, 20 minute useless kind of meeting that means nothing, that you get nothing from, to then have to go back into deep focus after that. It really just disrupts the whole day, really. So within engineering, I think it's hugely important to be very aware of these meetings and whether they're actually necessary, because you can't disrupt engineers really when they're in deep focus.
Yeah, I think you can, there are lots of ways you can get around it, aren't they? Your stand-up doesn't have to be in the morning. You don't have to necessarily, you know, there are certain things that you can do async, right? You don't necessarily have to have a synchronous stand-up. We used to have a previous company, we had Slack apps where people just posted their progress in Slack.
It's good.
That was what you needed, you know, maybe once a week or twice a week.
Mm.
There were stand-ups, but that was fine. But I guess the other thing is making those meetings productive.
Yeah.
So that you get something out of it. So it's not just a kind of, I know, you know, in Agile, we like to call them ceremonies, but they really shouldn't be ceremonies, right? They should be things where you want to go to them because you're getting something out of them. So you know that if you go, because you're blocked, right? And then if you go to that meeting, somebody will unblock you, then it's worth going to that meeting, right? If you're just going to the meeting to talk about a thing that there's no problem with it, then, you know, what are you going to get out of it?
Yeah. 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 It's just about being aware, really, whether it's necessary or if it's not necessary, how to make it necessary, rather than just getting stuck in a routine of doing it for the sake of it, I guess.
Yeah. What am I going to give to this meeting? What am I going to contribute? What am I going to get out of it? If the answer to both of those questions is nothing, then I would suggest don't go. And as a leader, I think if somebody says to me, I'm not going to contribute anything to this meeting, I'm not going to get anything out of it, I shouldn't just say, well, you know, your bum should be on the seat, come to it anyway. I should be like, yeah, fine, don't come, I don't care. Or what can I do to make it worth you going?
Yeah. I mean, that's all communication, isn't it? Again, it's all about, you know, knowing your team, speaking with your team one-on-one, you know, how can we make your working life better? What can we do in that way? I think that's a conversation that should happen more often, to be honest with you, with a lot of teams. Go on. Sorry, Sally.
I think a really important part of this is as a leader as well is knowing that different people have different communication styles, right? Knowing that some people will speak in a meeting, some people will never speak in a meeting, some people need to get the documents in advance, otherwise they won't be able to contribute. Some people can wing it and talk from the top of ad hoc, and other people can't do that. Knowing that some people would like to go to a meeting, assimilate the information, and then we'll talk to you about it afterwards, and that everybody has a different communication style. And that you have to learn, as a manager, you have to learn what they are, and you have to work with other people's preferences and adapt your own to them.
Absolutely.
Actually, not just a manager. Everybody should do that.
Yeah. That's true. Absolutely, yeah. I'm interested in, you know, as your leader, how did you learn about leadership? And would you say that your leadership style has changed over the years?
Yes.
Next question.
I think you learn about leadership by doing it, right? Yeah. There's a lot of learning on the job. I think one of the things that you flagged that you were going to ask me, that I'm going to preempt that, was what are the things that you wish you'd known at the start of your career that you learned as you're going along?
Yeah, that's it.
And I think actually one of them is that like everybody is not like you.
Yeah.
I think that is a key thing that has taken me a long time to figure out. And I think I've got quite a strong personality. I know what I'm good at. I know what I'm not good at. I know what my preferences are. I know that I like to, for example, I know that I like to see the big picture. And if people start giving me the details, my head will just explode. And sometimes you have a very strong sense of what you are and what your preferences are. It wasn't until I kind of went and did a couple of management training courses that I learned that not everybody was the same as me. And now, look, it sounds really obvious, doesn't it? Like, not everybody is the same as you, but that like other people respond to things in different ways than you do and have different motivations than you do. And I guess we all know that kind of in theory, don't we? That like not everybody is the same, but like knowing that very, very different things motivate other people than motivate you. And very, very, you know, people definitely have different styles and wishes and wants than you do was like a revelation to me. So you go to, typically you go to some management training and they go, oh, you're an introvert and you're, you know, a sensing person or a feeling person or whatever it is.
Yep.
And you're just like, yeah, that's what I am. I know that. But then to find out that people are very different than you, I think is so interesting. And I think managers are typically taken on these courses to find these things out, but everybody should find those things out, right?
That
people respond in different ways. It's the most important thing that I've learned as a manager, because you have to be like a chameleon.
Yeah, you do.
And to get the best out of people, you need to work with them in a way that they appreciate and that motivates them. So,
yeah. Yeah. I've got a question here. So I've asked this question quite a bit on the podcast because I think, I don't know, I'm not a leader or a manager, but how much does, you know, leadership and how much does it come down to being likable? Is that completely irrelevant to leadership?
Yeah.
Is it really? Yeah, that's everybody says this. Yeah.
I think you have to work with, well, in any job, whether you're a leader or not. I mean, you have to work with people who like you and who don't like you, and vice versa, who you like and don't like. And
yeah,
anybody who's going to kind of do well in, I mean, this is the thing, anybody who's going to do well in their career has to be adaptable to everybody else. It makes it easier sometimes if, you know, if you're likable. But what, I mean, what is likable anyway? Likable is generally somebody who is like you. Generally, you like people who are similar to you, I think. And that makes your working relationship easier because you're not asking things of them that they don't want you to ask. But I think that's the beauty and the challenge of management. It's like a puzzle. It's like, what motivates this person? What will make them do well? And how can I solve that puzzle? It's just problem solving.
I guess it is. It is, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, how much of leadership is being empathetic? I guess it must be quite a bit.
Oh, everything. I think everything about it is understanding. And I mean, not, you don't always, I think understanding other people, I think everything, you have to understand what motivates people. You have to understand why they've done, you know, what they've done. You've got to understand how to motivate them. All of those things require empathy, you know, and getting on with people that you wouldn't naturally get on with. I think that requires empathy, and all of those things are skills that leaders have to have, but everybody has to have, depending when you're navigating the workplace. A really interesting question. My manager asked me the other day, and I can't even remember why we were talking about this, but he said, which of your engineers are you like? Because I don't know why we were talking about it. And I was like, what a fascinating question. And yeah, I kind of like went through them all in my head. And I was like, I don't think I'm like any of them. I don't think there's anybody in my team. I think we've got nine people that I think I'm very similar to.
Right.
I could see like little bits of all of them that I'm like, but I think that's the beauty of being a manager, is like being able to like morph yourself into something that they want you to be.
Yeah.
In order to get most out of them.
Exactly. And it's probably a lot easier when you're hiring to go down the route of just hiring someone like yourself, because you think, I'll be able to manage this person really easily. I know how to respond. I know what makes them tick. But actually, that's not what you want, really, is it? A team of people all like yourself, you know, especially in terms of like diversity and inclusion and all that kind of thing. That's a whole different kettle of fish. But just in terms of the workplace environment, you don't want this, all the same kind of people, do you?
No, and I think that's taken me, interestingly, it's taken me a long time to realize the value of diversity in, and that sounds like a controversial thing to say, but you know, sometimes we talk about, oh, they'll be a good fit for us, or they've worked in a similar industry to ours, they'll be good, or you know, sometimes it's like they're like me, I like them, but it is quite often it's just like, oh yes, they're from a startup, they'll know what it's like working in a startup, they'll be a good fit. Or you know, at The Guardian, it might have been, you know, people have really bought into our project. You know, they love what The Guardian, the ethos of The Guardian is. So therefore, you know, they'll be a good fit because they're like, you know, into our project. Or, you know, another friend of mine works at a startup that says, you know, we really want people who buy into the ethos of our project. You're like, you can't just have people like that. You have to have, you know, even for the positive, what you think are the positive things, you know, in the end will work against you. You know, some of the best engineers I've worked with have been from like wildly different environments, wildly different companies, have wildly different worldviews.
Yeah.
You know, all of those things are amazing additions to have somebody with different insights. And I think actually in terms of the hiring, that's a really difficult place, is that if you're interviewing somebody and they're similar to you, then you can like massively over inflate, you know, your impression of them. And yeah, actually it's very good. It's really important then to have a kind of a really good rubric by which you can kind of like sense check your impression of them in any stage of interview. And similarly, if somebody who's very, very dissimilar to you, you can always, you know, you need to kind of have a good way of being able to measure whether they kind of come up to your hiring criteria, because you can undermark them. I think this thing's really important.
Yeah. I find it really interesting that, you know, being an engineer and then taking a step up to an engineering manager or an engineering leader, they're so wildly different in careers. You know, leading a team of engineers is so different to being an engineer. And someone told me something the other day, which was the first day that you become an engineering manager is the day that you're least experienced of being a manager. And then from then you can learn about actually being a manager. And it's so bizarre. It's not bizarre, but it's so fascinating that as an engineering manager, you have to learn so much about who you are as a person. Really, you really do.
It's the same with any job though, isn't it? Like your first day of doing it is like on the way you're least well equipped to do it.
That's true.
I think the good thing now though is that we have recognized generally as an industry that an engineering manager is not the only route to seniority for an engineer. So it was the case, I think, you know, 10 years ago probably, that, you know, the only way that you could become senior would be to be an engineering manager. And that was seen as a promotion from an engineer. And so, you know, engineers who wanted to be promoted became engineering managers, even though they might like absolutely loathe the idea of managing people. And, you know, I think as an industry now, we've cottoned on to that was not a good policy. And, you know, we've kind of created, you know, what might be dual tracks, where you can be, you know, an extremely senior engineer and or be a manager. And those are both kind of absolutely valid career paths. And, you know, I've managed people who are, you know, more senior engineers than me. I don't mean more senior engineers, but like more senior in the company in terms of kind of career ladders, they've been more senior than me. And, you know, that is, their input is, you know, massively, massively valuable. So, yeah, I think it's good that we now have kind of dual career track where you can choose the thing that you're better at and the thing that you're more inclined to want to do and the thing that motivates you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I don't want to keep you here too long, Sally. I know you're incredibly busy. So I can't even imagine how you've managed to squeeze out an hour of your day to do this, to be honest. So I've got one more question for you, if that's all right. As a leader, what would you say has been your greatest achievement or your proudest moment as a leader?
Oh gosh, this is a curveball. Yeah. Okay, my greatest achievement, I would say, my greatest achievement, my proudest moment, I think, probably was setting up an apprenticeship scheme at Deliveroo. We decided that we wanted to use the government's apprenticeship levy, which is a kind of a thing whereby the government give you tax relief in order to train people to be whatever you want them to be. We partnered with a company to have four apprentices join us, and we took two who had transferred internally from different roles in the company and two externally. We partnered with Makers Academy, who sent these people off to a boot camp to teach them the beginnings of how to code, and they then went through apprenticeship at the company and are now all fully fledged software engineers. And two of the, you know, and they were kind of some of them were kind of from, you know, diverse underrepresented groups. Two of them had career breaks and come back with other roles. And like the whole process, I kind of underestimated how much that kind of whole process of interviewing and selecting people and putting them through like pretty overwhelming experience of, you know, like you imagine when you know, you're kind of retraining and you're going to a boot camp and to be a software engineer and the whole of the world of software engineering is ahead of you and how you don't completely freak out, actually, at the amount of work that you have to do. But, you know, they all worked amazingly and are now all software engineers employed as, you know, pucker engineers at Deliveroo. And because partly my my insistence that we have an apprenticeship scheme there, that my assistants, my vision that we might have one, I think, and my you know, helping set that, helping, you know, the company realize that would be a good thing, is probably one of the things I'm most proud of.
Amazing. Absolutely amazing. I mean, I'm flabbergasted about how incredible your career is as well. It's phenomenal, really. Wow, what a career. And, you know, thanks so much for taking the time to do this. It's been so fascinating speaking to you and, you know, letting me pick your brains about this kind of thing. And it's just been really interesting. So, you know, thanks once again so much for taking the time to do this. And I'll leave you to get back to your day now, Sally, I'm sure. You've got about 100 emails to reply to and...
no email. We don't do email, actually.
Don't
it's all
you?
On Slack.
Oh, excellent. No. I love to hear that.
I've probably got about 3 emails at the max. Oh, living the dream. Living the dream.
Yeah, God. Yeah, well, yeah, thanks, Sally. Amazing.
No problems. Lovely to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform.